Eternity's Echo, JFK's Last Stand, Chapter 4, The Power of Restraint. The setting is the Oval Office, late afternoon. The tension in the room is palpable as JFK meets with the Joint Chiefs of Staff to discuss the latest intelligence on the Cuban Missile Crisis. One general, forceful, leaning forward, says,
"Mr. President, our latest inventory still shows that we have a significant advantage over the Soviets. We've got the bombers, we've got the advantage in missiles, and if we act now, while we still have the upper hand, we can deliver a decisive first strike. We can wipe out their capacity to retaliate and end this standoff before it escalates further or even puts us in peril."
JFK, calm but firm, hands steepled in thought, says,
"But General, answer me this. How many of our own people do we lose in the process? And how many of our cities will be turned to ash, even if we have what you might call a win?"
And the General, unyielding, his voice steady, says,
"We can't let them build up in Cuba. That's an act of aggression, plain and simple, and if we don't strike now, we might be handing them the advantage on a silver platter."
The president responds with a hint of frustration, his voice tinged with steel.
"There's a difference between responding to an act of aggression and starting a war that could end civilization as we know it. A U-2 spy plane being shot down isn't the same as a missile being launched at our cities. We can't let that distinction slip, General, and there's no coming back from a mistake like this. Hannibal used his elephants wisely. Know your military history. And like Hannibal, we must use our military assets wisely, too."
And the General is insistent, nearly pleading,
"Mr. President, we owe it to our citizens to act decisively. If we hesitate, if we lose our advantage, we could lose everything. Our intelligence suggests that they're moving fast, very fast. We need to be faster. And a first strike could cripple their capabilities before they have a chance to even strike back. We can win this thing and put it to rest now."
But Jack is firm, leaning forward slightly, emphasizing his words.
"If we act recklessly, we could lose everything anyway. There are no winners in a nuclear war, General. Only survivors, and not many at that. And let's not forget that the Soviets may still have missiles we don't know about, hidden in places we can't reach in time. Even a perfect strike could still leave us vulnerable."
The room grows tense, the weight of the decision pressing down on everyone present. The ticking of a clock underscores the pressure. The General, desperately searching for any argument that might sway the president, says,
"But the simulations, Mr. President, the projections show we can minimize our losses if we strike first. Even the fellow you brought in, Dr. Everett, his projections showed that. So we can protect the majority of our population."
Jack cuts him off.
"Minimize our losses. Are you saying we can protect the majority this way? We are not talking about numbers on a page, General. We are talking about millions of lives. American lives. Our responsibility is not about protecting the majority. It is about preventing the unnecessary loss of life."
A second general steps in, hoping to be more persuasive.
"Mr. President,
if we don't act, if we don't use our advantage while we still have it, we could be looking at far worse consequences than the losses we're talking about by using a first strike now. The Soviets won't hesitate to strike first if they think they can get the upper hand. And we have to consider the bigger picture."
Kennedy leans back contemplative. "And what about the picture that we can't see? The unintended consequences? The retaliation we can't anticipate?
A first strike could trigger a chain reaction that leads to the very destruction we're trying to avoid. And not just here, but across the globe."
The first general finally resigns himself to the fact that there will not be a first strike, at least now.
"Well, Mr. President, the decision is yours. But if we wait too long, we may lose our only chance to prevent
a Soviet strike. And the president responds with a steely resolve. We'll prepare for every eventuality, but I won't be the president who launches the first nuclear strike. We'll explore all of our options, but a reckless first strike isn't one of them. The scene shifts to a discreet location later that evening. The room is dimly lit, adding to the sense of urgency and secrecy. JFK and his brother Bobby have arranged a private meeting with Hugh Everett, the scientist, to discuss the growing pressure from the military to launch a first strike. Kennedy is tense and leaning forward says, Dr. Everett, the Joint Chiefs are pushing for a first strike. They say we have the advantage. They're using your data. If we strike first, what is the likely outcome of this?
Well, Mr. President, from a purely strategic viewpoint, yes, they are correct. We could, in theory, win such a war, but a win isn't necessarily a win like people might think. Victory would come at a catastrophic price. Massive casualties on both sides, nuclear fallout.
There's even a possible nuclear winter. Nothing grows for a very long time. Massive starvation, even more casualties, and that could be just the beginning. And Bobby leans in.
What do you mean, Hugh, that this is the beginning? Isn't that the worst of it?
And Everett pauses, choosing his words carefully. Well, not necessarily. You see, in the many worlds theory, every possible outcome of a decision plays out in its own separate reality. In one world, we emerge victorious, but in another, we might be utterly destroyed or just simply poison ourselves with all of the fallout. But it's not just about different outcomes. It's also about the interconnectedness of all these realities. The president's gaze levels.
Hugh, what does interconnectedness mean in this regard?
Well, if you look at the history of mankind and civilization, we've never had a nuclear war and an exchange. We might have initiated a couple of detonations, but that's it. No retaliatory strikes, no multiple strikes. If we initiate a war in this reality, the ramifications could ripple across multiple realities. It's like a stone thrown into a pond. These ripples could cause what you might call disruptions. We could see cracks between worlds, rifts where the fabric of reality begins to unravel itself. Bobby seizes on this and looks for context. You're talking about rifts? Are you saying that a nuclear war here could tear apart the universe?
And Everett nods. It's a possibility. In fact, it was thought about even with just one nuclear detonation. When you're dealing with forces as powerful as nuclear weapons combined with the sheer number of realities that we now know are involved, the potential for something catastrophic increases exponentially. These rifts could act as gateways, allowing, well, who knows what might be to come through. Forces, entities, we can't even begin to comprehend. I'll just call them dark forces. In other words, not something that's good. Nothing good can come of a nuclear exchange.
Jack leans forward, his voice tightening. Are you suggesting that a nuclear war could bring about something worse than the destruction of our world? And Everett, serious yet speculative, says, Yes, Mr. President. It could lead to the collapse of the barriers that keep these realities separate. And in doing so, we could unleash something far worse than a nuclear winter. Something antithetical to life itself. It's a rough analogy, but consider the Antichrist described within the Bible. Might it have been prophetic about something dark and awful coming forward at a particular time? It talks about an entity, but it could also be a result of what we bring upon ourselves. Jack recoils, himself a Catholic, but Everett goes on a more secular theory. Let's just consider the fact of things like antimatter and dark matter. These are forces that could consume everything in their path, including the very fabric of existence. A nuclear exchange might release these forces because no one knows where the antimatter is, and yet we know it exists. It seems to be absent, thankfully, otherwise we wouldn't have anything. Bobby, nearly whispering almost to himself, says, A ripple effect.
that could end everything, not just here, but everywhere.
And JFK, steely resolve in his voice, yet clearly disturbed, says, "And yet the generals insist we strike first to prevent an even greater disaster later. But if what you are saying is true or even possible, we might be inviting in the worst disaster we could ever imagine." And Everett, quiet but firm, says, "Well, it's a gamble with stakes far higher than they realize. Even if we win in this reality, if you call it a win, we could lose in countless others. It's just not about this world. And even if we don't care about the other worlds, it could still wash back up on us."
JFK steps forward. "There will be no first strike. We will find another way."
And Everett, the man who had been hired to draw up a first strike scenario, nods at that.
"I believe that that's the only choice we have, Mr. President. Yes, if we have to retaliate, but there's no strike against us to retaliate for."
Bobby, still under the shock of it all, speaking almost to himself, says,
"We can't be the ones who open that door, Jack. And with a first strike, we are opening that door."
And JFK turns to his brother.
"Bobby, Hugh, you have my word. As long as I'm the president, there will be no first strike unless absolutely necessary."
As the room fell into a tense silence, the weight of Dr. Everett's warning hung in the air. JFK knew that the stakes were far greater than any battlefield. They were about the very fabric of existence itself. Faced with the pressure of his military leaders, the president resolved that the path forward required more than just strength. It demanded wisdom, restraint, and a profound respect for the unknown.